Leif Enger, hailed as a storyteller of great humanity and huge heart, is the author of the New York Times bestseller Peace Like a River, which has sold well over a million copies, and Virgil Wander, both novels beloved by readers around the globe for their grace, charm, and depth of meaning. I Cheerfully Refuse is his latest novel, set in a not-too-distant America, a tale of a bereaved and pursued musician embarking under sail on Ascension Lake Superior in search of his departed, deeply beloved bookselling wife. Amidst the Gulliver-like challenges of life at sea and no safe landings, Rainey, the endearing bear of an Orphean narrator, is lifted by physical beauty, surprising humor, generous strangers, and an unexpected companion in a young girl who comes aboard. The novel is a symphony against despair and a rallying cry for the future. Leif Enger's latest is I Cheerfully Refuse, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Leif Enger to this week's book show. What a delight to have you on the program. Thank you so much for being here.
You know, I'm honored to talk to you. I enjoy your show, and it's a thrill to be on it.
Well, thank you very, very much. I greatly appreciate that. I enjoyed this novel so much, and I want to begin with, I guess, the origin story, in the sense of, at what point did you make the decision that this was going to be in the future, but not all that far in the future, in a future that I think most of us can very much picture and imagine?
Yeah, I mean, I never really had it in my mind to write a dystopian novel. I think mostly because, and much as I enjoy them, I like to read a good dystopia story, but most of them are set in motion by something that is beyond our control. There's a huge pandemic, or there are asteroid strikes, an AI takeover, or whatever it might be. There's so many ways we can go wrong. But it struck me that maybe it would be useful to imagine the kind of dystopian future that we could easily just sort of sleepwalk into, that we might one day wake up and find ourselves in a situation without really thinking about it, where, for example, 16 people own everything, where, you know, our friends and neighbors are in work camps. Right. In order not to starve. These things seem to me worth imagining because they don't seem particularly impossible. I think it's quite easy to put yourself in Rainey's shoes. And so without anything more to go on than that, I imagined this character. And he was just right there. He was right there. And the great thing about writing a story is that once you begin and once you've found the voice of the narrator, then it's just a matter of showing up every day and listening to what he's saying, you know? It's not really a matter of imagining a message or imagining thematics or trying to persuade. By then, you're in the grip of the story and you're in the grip of the narrator's voice. And so it becomes just a way of working and getting through the day. And I wrote this during the heart of the pandemic, and I found that to be a very useful thing in a way of propping myself up during what seemed like pretty dark days.
Could it be argued that it is tinged with a darkness because of the pandemic?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no question about it. Those were frightening days. Nobody knew what was going to happen. Nobody understood the disease. I remember going to the grocery store and, you know, washing blueberries, washing boxes of cereal, wiping everything down. We all went through this. And so it was a point of commonality. But yeah, I mean, I think they were dark days, even though for me, I work at home. And so I'm home anyway. And my wife and I actually got a lot of good walks down the leafy streets of Duluth. So in many ways, the pandemic was not terrible for me. And it took everything else but writing this book off of my plate. And so in a way, that was, you know, that was quite wonderful.
Tell us about Rainey, of this character, as you say, was very much there for you. Because, and not in the nautical sense, but not in the nautical sense, a very even-keeled human being.
Well, yeah. And there again, I think that maybe I write what I need at the time. I think a lot of writers do this. They're looking around for a voice to tell the story, and they land on one that provides them with some kind of ballast. And Rainey seemed to me like a man. He came, for example, late to reading. He can read, but he doesn't really. That's part of the future that he lives in, is a future where illiteracy is on the rise, publishing is on the decline, or it's gone. And yet he falls into this practice of reading and reading widely. And that is what gives him, I think, an ability to imagine a world that is not just his own point of view. He can imagine what other people might be thinking. He cares what other people might be thinking. He's a man who is inclined to think the best of people because his default is that he doesn't know what they're motivated by. And so he assumes the best. That eventually is what gets him in trouble, but it's also what enables him, I think, to endure the trouble that he gets into.
There's certainly a darkness to this novel, but there is so much beauty in it as well. And I think that comes from this character, doesn't it? That he notices it. He's aware of the beauty.
Oh, he's aware of it. He notices it. It's something that, he's always been, I think, drawn to outdoors. Look, during the pandemic, the thing besides writing that kept me going were the long walks that I would take, usually with my wife, through Duluth and following the streams down to the lake and then walking along Lake Superior. And it's really hard to be too bent out of shape if you are out in the world, if you're out in nature, if you're listening to bird calls, if you are walking under the shade of trees, it's kind of hard to panic. I think that Rainey, he has what Mary Oliver, the poet, called the attention that leads to devotion. And I think that that is a good way to live, and that's how Rainey sees the world. He pays attention to it, and because he does, he loves it.
He encounters loss very quickly in the novel, which is crushing, and yet there's something that keeps him going.
Yeah, absolutely. He does encounter the most unbearable loss that a man probably can. And I dreaded that. I saw it coming. I don't really plan my novels out very well. It's one reason it takes me so long to write them. But they unfold organically, and I saw this loss coming, and I did not want to write it. But then I also thought, well, we'll see what Rainey is made of. We'll see how well his hope and his optimism get him through. If he's really up against it, what will he do? And it was actually a joy to write about his coping with a remarkable loss, a crushing loss. And it gave me a lot of hope just to listen to him telling me his story and to write it down.
Leif Enger is our guest. The name of the new novel is I Cheerfully Refuse, and it is published by Grove. The novel's title comes written by somebody who looms large in this story, and that is Molly Thorne and her memoir, I Cheerfully Refuse. How did that become the heart of this?
Well, there again, I think we encounter the books that we need when we need them. Molly Thorne is described as a memoirist, novelist, and poet of the middle 20th century. And Rainey's wife, Lark, is a bookseller, a kind of rogue bookseller at a time when booksellers get pipe bombs thrown through their windows. And the book that she has been trying her whole life to find is this book by Molly Thorne, I Cheerfully Refuse, which a few hundred copies of advanced reader copies were printed, but it never actually made it to press. And so the copies are rare. The book has been described by people as a sort of hymn to the future, a contract with beings not yet conceived. In other words, an incredibly hopeful book. And so when Lark finds it, Rainey's wife, Lark, his bookselling wife, when she finds it, she is just in a state of delight. Rainey himself, part of him wishes she had not found it because, as he points out, the perfect book remains unread. Build up stories in our minds, and then when we read them, sometimes they disappoint. He is afraid that's going to happen. Instead, what happens is that that book, that advanced reader copy, becomes a source of inspiration and a source of hope for Rainey as he is working his way through the various battles that he has to fight before the end of the story.
There's a moment that I love in the novel where when Lark discovers the book at the bookstore, and there's an assumption from Rainey that his wife, who has wanted this book for so long, had already read it and is surprised that she didn't. I often feel that way with a book that I desperately want to read, that you want to wait till all the circumstances are right.
Oh yeah, it's always tempting just to put it off. I only recently read Cormac McCarthy's last two books, which were published a couple of years ago now in very close succession, for exactly that reason. I was afraid that maybe they would disappoint. Maybe the reason they were held off so long was because he was having difficulty writing them, and maybe that difficulty would show. It took a long time to work up the courage to read them. I finally did, and I love them both, I'm happy to say. I'm now in that place with the posthumous Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel Until August, which I have, but I haven't yet cracked.
And that one's harder because it didn't go through the author's final edit and draft, which is different.
It is different.
I found Cormac McCarthy, who I'm a huge fan of. I had a lot of problems getting through the first novel, and then when after I read the second, I was like, okay, now this all makes sense, and this is a beautiful duo, and it's an
Yeah.
incredible book, and I'm very glad they published it the way they did.
Yeah, me too. That second one really put the first one into focus.
And wonderful context. And you feel like you're being manipulated, which I guess is what a good storyteller does. But I thought, oh, and then, oh, this is really cool. This is how I would like to feel after reading Cormac McCarthy's
Let me
final
ask,
novel.
how did you respond to the idea in The Passenger that he sets up like the perfect locked room mystery and then just walks away from it?
Yeah. Well, and don't you think, I mean, who else could get away with it though, right?
No one I can think of.
Right. I mean, and to the point of where I'm sure if you had done that, you would have people at Grove saying, "Leaf, let's talk."
Oh, absolutely. And they would be right to do it.
Let's have a conversation. I don't know how much I've asked other authors about this, but I find it fascinating because many times when I talk, authors will say that they don't read avidly when they're writing, or they read certain types of things that get them ready, or but do you ever feel that reading when you're working on something that there's a almost a response, a feeling, a mode, a vibe that it puts you in?
I think you have to be really careful what you read when you're, I mean, just for me, I'm such a sponge. I'm such a, I don't know, I'm kind of a chameleon. And so I don't read McCarthy when I'm writing. That was the other reason I just put off those books, because I thought, no, I just don't dare. His style is so strong that it can overwhelm somebody like me, or Marquez for that matter. I mean, it's very difficult if you're reading Garcia Marquez not to start writing in sort of long, looping, elliptical sentences in which strange things happen and people lift off the ground. So I do have to be careful what I'm reading. That said, if I never read anything while I was writing, I would never read any novels because I'm so perilously slow. So I have to read, and I read most things, but if there's a stylist of unusual strength, I will avoid them until I'm between drafts.
Does the process for you, do you look at it when you talk about it taking you a long time? But that's what it takes, right? I mean, it's not something that you're looking to improve upon. That's what it takes. It's like you read the recipe and it says bake it for 2 hours as opposed to 30 minutes.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be nice sometimes if you could just bake something in 20 minutes instead of baking it in 8 years, you know?
Well, sure.
Bake for 8 years. I mean, there are times when I'm a little frustrated at my slowness, but then I do find that for me, it's kind of worth the trouble. It's worth the wait. I write slowly because I write a lot of drafts. I write a lot every day, but most of it's rewriting. You know, I will write two or three fresh pages, and then I'll go back over what I wrote in the previous few days and work on those, and often reduce, you know, a 15-page section to, I don't know, five paragraphs, just because I'm pretty wordy when I start out, and that has to be, it has to be brought down. It has to be controlled. It has to be turned from something discursive and sometimes not very pretty to something that has bite. And I will say that, you know, you're a radio guy. Writing for radio is really kind of one of the main things that taught me how to write a good sentence and a good story. When I started with radio, I mean, maybe you had 3.5 minutes in which to craft a story, a 3.5 minute window. And in that 3.5 minutes, you needed to set the stage, introduce the primary characters. With any luck at all, there was a plot twist or two you had to get to, and then you had to bring it into a conclusion and kind of bring it in for a safe landing. And that was excellent training. That was such good training. Some of these stories were large, but you have a window. And boy, does that teach you a thing or two about adjectives.
Well, and you talk about a window, but you worked for Minnesota Public Radio, but you have a deadline.
You have a deadline. That's right.
You're writing and you're creating and you're being creative under deadline.
I mean, that's the best training a fiction writer can ask for, I think.
But the opposite is when you're not doing that and you have freedom, all bets are off. You can take the time that you need.
Yeah. And, maybe my radio stories would have been fantastic if I could have taken, 6 or 8 weeks on
Yeah. We've had
them.
reporters like that here, sure. I think that though the beauty that you have in your writing, it's beautifully crafted. You can tell, you can see the work, I think.
Yeah, well, you want it to read easily. You want your sentences to flow. Another thing I learned from radio, and I'm sure you know this is true, is that you have to go into a studio and record your story. And if it's badly written, it's very hard to read it in a convincing way. I used to go into a studio and record a piece, and I would stumble all over myself. And I remember the first time an editor said, "Well, the reason you can't read it worth anything is because you've got some clumsy sentences in there. You need to rewrite the sentences, and then your reading will even out." So, the audible element of radio winnows out a lot of bad writing. And so I just took that into my fiction writing, and so now I read, often I'll finish a section that I'm working on, and I'll run downstairs with the pages and say to my wife, "Can I try this out on you?" and read it aloud. And she'll give me her full attention, and if I stumble, I know it's time to rework that bit.
Leif Enger is our guest. The new novel is I Cheerfully Refuse. That brings up an interesting point about as you rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, that when it hits an editor, when you send it off and it goes to the editor, does that make those conversations more intense or perhaps greater in depth because you've already been working on this in your brain for a really long time?
It makes those conversations really easy to have because by the time my editor sees it, I know it inside and out. And I can speak clearly about it because I know the people, I know the subject matter. To some extent, I know the subtext, but I would say that my knowledge of that is incomplete. I sometimes work with more intuition than knowledge. I don't really understand all the time what's going on under the hood. I just know intuitively where the story needs to go and the language that I need to tell it.
So that's fascinating. So you may not always know what is happening subconsciously.
No, I sometimes don't. Other times I do, but often I'm just going where the voice seems to take me. Now, I'm very lucky to have a brilliant editor, Elizabeth Schmitz at Grove, who really understands my work well, and she has been incredibly helpful to me in, seeing where there's a blind spot in a book. On each of my books, she's helped me to see things that needed to be improved or fleshed out or winnowed out. There's always a certain amount of work to do, but I love being edited. It's being edited is a privilege, and every time I get edited, my work gets better.
When you were working on this book and that moment where you have clarity as to where it's going and what it is saying on pretty much all levels, is that a defining moment in the process?
I don't remember a moment where you suddenly say, "Ah, now everything clicks." What happens for me is that I will have 4 or 5 elements that I think are going to happen, scenes that I'm writing toward, scenes of some sort of dramatic value, a conflict, sometimes a comedic scene, sometimes a violent scene, but things that I know are coming and that are sort of signposts that are getting me to where I want to go. But I don't really have that feeling of, "Oh, now it's complete," until I've written the last scene and the last line. And then I think, "I have a draft." And then you go back when you have a draft and the work starts over again. And that's really when the joy happens because rewriting is, man, that's where all the pleasure is. Joe. That's where the pleasure is. Not really in the invention or the plotting, although sometimes that's fun too. But the rewriting, when you take a page that is, messy, doesn't really know what it's about, you transform a sloppy scene into, three sharp paragraphs that matter. Oh, that's there's nothing to match it.
That's a wonderful feeling. Rainey comes off as so this inadvertent rebel, and I think probably would even be surprised himself by what he is capable of, what he is able to witness and get through.
Yeah, well, look, Rainey doesn't think of himself as the protagonist of anything. Rainey is a bass player. He's the kind of musician who stands in the shadows and who lays a foundation for the rest of the musicians who take the song wherever it needs to go, and who sort of fly above the bass line and provide the sparkle and the beauty. And he sees his role in life, I think, kind of that way, in his marriage with Lark. She's certainly the one that people gravitate to and are won over by, and she's just her kindness and her curiosity. And he sees himself as kind of a support system, I think, for her and for the friends in his life. And so, no, he's not really thinking of himself as somebody who might be called upon to be a man of action. He never really, he's just not the leading man, really, in his own mind. And it's really enjoyable to write about somebody like that. It's kind of a pleasure to hear what someone who is by nature kind of retiring and not someone who's ever going to go looking for trouble. It's really fun to put him in dire situations and say, what, Rainey, what are you going to do? What's he going to do?
A book filled with dire situations that you end up feeling, as I close the book, filled with hope.
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, I really wanted that to be the takeaway from this novel, because it's easy to be bleak, but it's necessary to be hopeful. I heard a great interview with Kim Stanley Robinson, who wrote a great book called The Ministry for the Future. He's written a lot of science fiction novels, and that's his sort of climate change book. And it's huge. It's over 500 pages, and I was intimidated by it, but I picked it up because I heard him talking about it on the radio. And what he said was, I'm going to butcher this, but the essence was this, Joe. He said, hope and optimism are actually our duties. We have a duty to the future to be hopeful. And the reason is that hope is what keeps the landing strip clear for the muse. In other words, there are all these brilliant ideas circling overhead. Some of them are just ideas for practical things that are make our lives better. Some of them are ideas for books. Some of them are ideas for songs, whatever they are. But it's really hard to be productive if you are in despair. It's hard. Despair doesn't write any novels. It doesn't make any movies. And so I think what Rainey is cheerfully refusing here at bottom is hopelessness. I think he's refusing despair.
Which is especially potent considering you're writing this at a time when the world is in great despair. It's dealing with an event that seems unfathomable, that we have a complete lockdown, and yet you're still writing about hope.
Maybe I just needed to at the time, I think that a great motivator for my writing has always been to try to figure out the world, to try to decide what I believe about it, to try to identify what I'm hopeful about, and to address the things that make me feel like I'm in pain, or like despair is beckoning. I mean, there have been times in all our lives when despair is just looking in every window. And I think that I write in order to try to upend that scenario a little bit, to find something to be hopeful about. And in Rainey's case, that was quite easy. Rainey picked me up and carried me through this story, and I miss it now that it's done. I miss the work.
I think you should give classes and how to figure out the world. We need that.
Oh, I haven't got it figured out, Joe. I'm sure I'm enjoying the trip.
That's good. Yeah, as long as you can enjoy the ride to Pittsburgh, sure, that's good. The name of the new novel is I Cheerfully Refuse. It is published by Grove. It's just a magnificent novel, and it's such a beautiful piece of work. And I thank you so much for sharing with us. What a delight.
Thanks, Joe. It was a pleasure to visit with you.
Be well. Once again, Lee Fenger's latest is I Cheerfully Refuse. It is published by Grove. I'm Joe Donahue.